Sound Opinions is supported by Goose Island Beer Company, a Chicago craft brewery that works to innovate new ways to brew and age beer. More at gooseisland.com. You don't need to be the only beer you drink. We just want to be the best beer you drink.
This is Sound Opinions. I'm Jim DeRogatis. My partner is Greg Kot. And coming up, we're going to review new music by The National and Queens of the Stone Age. But first, we're talking about separating art from artist. Can you appreciate the artistic output of someone when he or she has done some horrible things?
That is a very difficult question, Jim, and it's one that we've been thinking a lot about here in recent weeks, in large measure because of your recent reporting in BuzzFeed about R. Kelly. Now, remind us about the stories that have run already.
Greg, you know, there were two stories this summer, one in July and one in August, but really the R. Kelly story dates back until the mid-90s, where he has allegedly abused his position of wealth and fame to pursue illegal underage relationships with young women. It's a harrowing story. He, of course, married Aaliyah when she was 15 under a falsified wedding license. There have been four public lawsuits filed against him and many out-of-court cash settlements. He was tried and acquitted on 14 counts of making child pornography. My latest stories are about Kelly allegedly housing several legal age women who are subject to a strict regimen of rules. And if they break any of them, they are physically and mentally abused. They're separated from their families. The parents in two families very much want their daughters back. They're 21 and 18. And the follow-up story was about yet another young woman who began a relationship with him at age 16, not long after. She met him, Greg, in the courtroom while he was being tried for child pornography, facing 15 years behind bars. This sexual relationship for this young woman went on for about 8 months. She also alleged physical and mental abuse. Yet he's had one of the most successful careers in the history of R&B.
Yeah, this is a story that is not new, Jim, in terms of separating the art from the artist. It is something that is part of all art forms, really, and certainly rock and roll in the rock and roll era. We're going back to the days of Chuck Berry, Jerry Lee Lewis, controversial figures, important artistic figures whose troubled personal lives, you know, we have to deal with when discussing their art. We certainly wrestle with this issue all the time, and we're going to be talking about it today. We're joined by Britt Julius, a Chicago journalist who has written for the Chicago Tribune, Esquire, Elle, and others.
Thank you for having me.
And Mark Anthony Neal, a professor of African and African-American studies at Duke.
Hey, great to be on.
Let me start with a quote by Oscar Wilde, and I want to get both of your reactions to it. So Oscar Wilde, the great critic and philosopher of Victorian England, said, I'm paraphrasing because he was talking about books, but he said, art is neither moral nor immoral. It is merely good or bad. So, Britt, do you buy that? Is there a moral core to art?
I think so. I think that I think not all art operates under a moral core, but I think that it exists. I think that especially, you know, art that is maybe dealing with issues of feminism or race or gender, things like that, I think that that's sort of operating under the idea of trying to, you know, get at the root of individual rights and, you know, sharing people's perspectives and things like that. So for me, I think that, you know, it can, you know, and it should maybe have a moral core, but it doesn't always have that.
Mark, you've been wrestling with this for your entire critical and academic career. So moral or no?
I have to agree with Oscar Wilde, man. I think art is art. I think morality plays into it in terms of what we're going to do with that art, how we circulate that art, what kind of meanings we derive from that art. I always like to think that the art is pure. The artists are not pure.
No, they're human
but the
beings.
Art itself,
no human
right,
being
right.
is pure. Right.
But the art is an expression of this particular person, this particular entity of being trying to express something artistic. Of course, everything that gets expressed is an art, and that's another part of the conversation, right? Mm. Who gets to choose what is art and what isn't? You know, I've been wrestling with Kelly as I wrestled with Miles Davis, as you can wrestle with Marvin Gaye.
James Brown.
There's no James Brown. I mean, there's no defense of Kelly, but Kelly does exist in a fundamentally different, you know, media context where we know so much more about R. Kelly, and in some ways because he has let us know so much more about R. Kelly than we would ever know about, you know, Marvin Gaye and James Brown or Bill Withers, you know, beyond what would have been a Jet magazine article, you know, 35 years ago. Very often when I look at Mr. Kelly and what he individually represents, it's as much an indictment of who he is as a human being as it is for people who have supported him. And that's where, you know, for me, it was the final break. I'm one of those folks who actually thinks that when you look at his body of work, there is some art there, right? This isn't just a dude who was trying to make hits. But at some point, the fact that he becomes such this compelling figure that folks continue to go back and support him, that's as much an indictment about us and what we're willing to accept in our artists as it is as much an indictment of who he is.
There's this area, in, especially in popular culture, I think, where transgressive behavior is expected sometimes, even condoned or championed, you know, sex, drugs, rock and roll. You're cooler because of that. You are more authentic because you actually did hold up a gas station and dealt drugs as a rapper, let's say, or as a rock and roller. Jimmy Page is not diminished at all by the fact that he had groupies and, you know, a relationship with a 14-year-old girl in the early 70s. I mean, back in the day, that kind of behavior seemed to be more a stamp of, oh, that's true rock and roll. Britt, you were arguing against that. You said that's you don't buy that at all.
No, I mean, I think that might have, you know, made sense, you know, 30, 40, 50 years ago when that was sort of how we expected, you know, rock stars to perform. But I think that the way that we listen to and consume music is a lot different than it was back then. And I think, you know, in large part, they were, you know, a lot of artists like that were sort of playing into specific, you know, tropes, and it was presented as a specific way to fit into a rock and roll ideal. I think people aren't necessarily relying on that anymore when it comes to the music that they're consuming, in which case, you know, we don't need to and we shouldn't be accepting, you know, okay, well, they're just going to do whatever they want to, because that's what is accepted of them as, you know, a rock musician or as a rapper or things like that. At some point, we have to sort of ask, okay, well, what are we going to continue to allow to accept? Is it okay for these people to do it, but then in real life, it's not okay? Like, where's the line?
So you're saying, you know, standards change, the way we perceive things change, but does that wipe out for you the work of James Brown or Miles Davis or even Picasso, who was, you know,
not
notoriously
a nice
abusive of women and, right, and his many wives? You know, the list goes on and on of artists who have had these really transgressive, even criminal backgrounds, personal histories, and yet made great art, in either in spite of it or because of it. I'm not sure what the real answer is.
I think that art that was maybe made before I was sort of, you know, aware of what the artist was doing, for me, I've kind of drawn that line where I'm like, okay, like, I grew to love it and understand it before I sort of had the perspective or knowledge of what was actually taking place. But I think now, as we're seeing, you know, artists, even like the group, you know, Power Bottom, you know, that was a very swift sort of, you know, as soon as we found that out, you know, everyone was just sort of like, well, we're done with them. Like, that's just how it is. So I think that we're learning and we're getting better at it. I don't think that I'm perfect. I don't think that anyone is perfect.
So you think people now are more, quote unquote, woke?
Yes.
And the internet makes people aware?
Yes.
Mark is laughing at that one. Well, because we have seen in indie rock, we've seen several conflicts. Power Bottom was this indie rock group just about to put out this record, and there was an accusation of sexual assault, and they were dropped by their label and vilified overnight. R. Kelly, the first lawsuit was filed in the mid-90s.
Yeah.
Well, Mark, do you buy that digital culture is changing?
You know, the internet piece is interesting because, you know, the reason why you're talking about this now on BuzzFeed is because there's a whole new generation now that can take him to task for it in ways that folks weren't established to be able to do that before. I think the classic takedown of Bill Cosby is another example, right? When Bill Cosby becomes a thing again, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, that some of us are going like, we've known this for decades, right? Why is this a thing now?
Right.
Well, now because a young generation now is attuning their attention to it, and now they have different array of tools to be able to use to actually hold folks accountable. So I think Kelly's being held accountable in a way now, right, that he hadn't been in the past.
Absolutely.
You know, my initial instinct is that anybody can say anything because that's our country is built on that.
If we can't, I would think that all four of us here are free speech absolutists.
Our artists can express themselves in any way they see fit. But where do we hold accountable people like the record companies that put that music out? The agents who book those tours, the promoters who sign them up to play arenas, the ticket buyers themselves who are supporting this artist with their cash.
No, there's a haunting line in my interview with a woman who had an underage sexual relationship with Kelly, who said, "Everybody in my life, all my friends, my family loved R. Kelly, and my favorite radio station was WGCI, who played him every half hour." Mm-hmm. Is GCI responsible?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it goes right down the line. I think everybody has to look in their own conscience, right, Mark? I mean, it seems to me like it's almost like a personal decision how you deal with it. You know, as soon as we start imposing, like, you cannot say this on a record, you know, you must go away and never record again. You know, we're in trouble.
And Edgar says back, you know, when he finally gets brought up on charges, you know, the first line of defense here should have been to go after radio stations that continued to play his music. But of course, there was no larger infrastructure in place to really hold radio accountable in that kind of way. There was no way to target radio with a Black Twitter campaign, for instance, or, you know, to do all these kinds of things that social media has given us a tool. You know, so Black radio played what they thought their audience wanted to hear, and they continued to play R. Kelly, and he continued to be somebody who was represented as okay within that context, right? Because you could imagine people saying, well, like, if he's been accused, why are they still playing his records, right? Mm-hmm. He must not be right. You know, let's have him his day in court. And of course, the fact that he was acquitted just complicates this even more.
I think when it comes to someone like R. Kelly, though, like, from, I guess the more I think about it, the more confused I am, because it's not like he's releasing a whole bunch of, like, new music. It's not, do you know what I mean? Like, it's not like
he put out a Christmas album.
But even in
November, and he went on The Tonight Show on December 23rd and got a big old bear hug from Jimmy Fallon after singing his Christmas songs.
It's so strange to me because it's not like he's at the top of people's thoughts when it comes to, you know, the best sort of contemporary R&B musicians.
Yeah, no,
and yet the radio stations will still play, you know, Step in the Name of Love as if, you know, it just came out, you know, three or four months ago.
He doesn't own the world the way he once did.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's a good point. And, you know, I think also a factor here is, you know, you practically grow up with an artist like this, right? And he was this kind of celebrated figure in Chicago for a long time. He was, you know, larger than life. He still is for some people.
Yeah, there are murals on the South
and
Side.
And once you hit a certain level, it's very hard to knock that person way down to the bottom again because they've built up so much. I hate that we use a term like goodwill, but it's certainly a sense of stature. And whereas a band like Power Bottom, they're just starting out.
Exactly.
Nobody really knows who they are. And they go, oh, you're accused of sexual assault? No way, man. I'm not listening to another note you play. That should be the response to R. Kelly at this point. You know, I've gotten to the point where I can't even listen to a record of his anymore. I think for a lot of people, it's just like it's really hard for them to go take that next step and say he doesn't mean anything to me anymore. Because he obviously did mean something to you, right, Britt? I mean,
especially
he meant
Chicago.
Something to you
yeah,
at some point.
He did. I think it was really hard for me to separate, especially when I was younger, like R. Kelly, the artist, from the R. Kelly that I knew, because I was very aware of the trial growing up and, you know, its connections, you know, to my school and, you know, everyone I knew, especially, you know, my sister's age is a couple years older than me. They all had some sort of like R. Kelly story. But, you know, I also grew up really loving I Believe I Could Fly, right? Like that was my age group. And so it was really targeted to me in that way. And I think also in Chicago, we have, you know, we sort of obsess over our you know, hometown heroes or our celebrities in a way that maybe people from other places don't.
I Believe I Can Fly. He was collaborating with Michael Jordan.
Exactly.
Yeah, the two greatest Chicago heroes of all time.
In the 90s, like it was just, you know, so. But yeah, I think kind of like what you were saying, Greg, you kind of have to work through it eventually. I think for me, the older I got as a woman and having my own experiences in terms of, you know, sort of having to face like, you know, sexual assault or sexual violence, that really sort of changed things for me. It's like, why am I supporting someone when I know what my own life has been like, what I know what my friends' life, you know, lives have been like, what they have faced, what they continue to face? I'm being a hypocrite, you know? I'm completely not showing up for people in the way that I should. I'm making some sort of an exception because of a song. That's silly. That doesn't make any sense. And as a music fan, there's so many other songs and in artists that I can enjoy who don't have that sort of that, you know, that history, that violence, that baggage that's attached to them as well.
I always tell my students, you know, whether it's Birth of a Nation or Eminem, right? It's like, look, there's no right and wrong or wrong in art. I just think if you are a thoughtful consumer of culture or just somebody who loves music, all right, well, whatever. If you love this, you must respect it. And part of respecting is knowing what's the story here? What is the message of this art and where is it coming from? Who is the person who's bringing it?
Yeah. There's so many other artists that I love, and I love their music because of their autobiographical background, you know, and how mm-hmm. that sort of plays a role into, like, the lyrics of the music or, you know, where they were in their personal life, how that sort of, like, you know, developed into, like, an album or a song. And so I really appreciate that, you know. So I, for myself, it's like, how can I, you know, in one hand, you know, really love that and really, like, appreciate that in an artist, but then also, you know, with an artist like R. Kelly or other artists who are similar to them who, you know, a lot, as we've said, of their, you know, their background sort of plays a role into the art mm-hmm. that they're actually creating.
It's right.
How could I then ignore it? It doesn't make any sense.
You know, we have been talking a lot about black male figures in this discussion, Mark and Britt. Stereotyping, how big of a factor? Racism, how big of a factor is that in the way these cultural figures are perceived versus their white male counterparts, let's say? Britt, what do you think?
I think it is, you know, a factor. Is it the biggest factor? I don't know. But I do think, you know, the example, like a very, you know, recent example I can think of is something like a Nate Parker versus Casey Affleck and how that sort of situation was really handled. And, you know, Casey Affleck had, you know, a lot of institutional support, you know, through his brother and, you know, his brother's best friend.
Pretty good thrashing, though.
He did, but it wasn't, you know, but he still won the Oscar. He's still, you know, still in more, you know, his campaign to, you know, to win that Oscar, you know, there's always the Oscar campaigns was somewhat tarnished. But, you know, again, like I feel like a lot of editorials that I was seeing, they were, you know, on women's interest site, like a Jezebel or a place like that. It wasn't necessarily the sort of thing. Like a Bill Cosby where it's making the cover of New York Magazine, right?
And Woody Allen still gets the honors.
Absolutely, yeah. So I there definitely is a difference in terms of the perception of it. Is it the biggest factor? Is it the thing that really separates, you know, who does sort of, you know, get completely like ostracized or removed from the you know, artistic or entertainment community? I don't know. I can't necessarily say.
Right. I mean, but that's the rub, right? The fact that black men have historically been depicted as sexual predators can't keep us from holding accountable those black men who actually are sexual predators.
Yep. Yeah.
I think, and very often, you know, some of these figures, depending on how big their celebrity has been, have been able to protect themselves because they knew the community was sensitive to the fact that black men have been portrayed historically as sexual predators. I mean, it's one of the reasons why when you look at folks who close ranks around these figures, you know, what's almost alarming as the R. Kelly case is the fact that in many cases, it's been black women who have closed ranks around him. Mm. It's been black women who've been critical of the girls who he assaulted and he raped and he attacked, right? Again, out of this idea that we need to protect black men. I'm sure one of the narratives that we're going to deal with now, even as his R. Kelly story continues to be something of significance, is, you know, why are we talking about R. Kelly when all this other stuff is happening, right? Well, because even if we have to fight a fight around the reemergence of white supremacy and Nazis and white nationalists, we still have to make sure that we don't have sexual predators in our community. You know, there's a way in which we have to do both of those things at the same time, right? In fact, it demeans us to not deal with the realities of race as we live race in the world and not also deal with the fact that there are sexual predators within our community.
The question I have, as we're going forward from this, have lessons been learned? Is there a sense of we are going to hold artists to a higher standard now as a result of the revelations that Jim has been reporting about R. Kelly and the power bottom incident?
How about Woody Allen?
Yeah,
if Bill Cosby wanted to make one last Cosby, you know, album or Roman Polanski finally comes back to the United States of America? Right?
I think in the digital world, you're seeing, you know, one Twitter account can ruin your career, you know? Are we going to, what do you think, Britt? Do you think going forward, have lessons been learned? Are we going to be seeing more accountability? from our artists?
I think there will be more accountability, but I think that as we've kind of seen out and we've kind of discussed a little bit, the way that it plays out is different for different types of artists. So, you know, from what I've seen, it seems to be, you know, a lot of male artists, they have to really do a lot of damage, you know, for us to sort of take them into account versus maybe like an up and coming artist or even just, you know, like a female pop star, you know, tweets the wrong thing and suddenly people are like, you know, Katy Perry is canceled party, things
or
like that.
Kathy,
you know,
Griffin takes a photo that's in bad taste and like, boy, she's vilified instantly.
Exactly. Right. And so, yeah, so I think that there will be more, there will be and there has been more accountability, but I don't think it's going to necessarily play out for every type of artist in the way that it should.
Mm-hmm. There's this double standard, I think, right? For men and for powerful men. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mark, what do you think?
I mean, I look at the career arc of someone like Rick Ross, who's really at the point in his career where he can never say anything publicly about women again. One, because everything he says is so stupid and ridiculous, right? But systematically, folks have been holding him accountable for some of his commentary, right? So that accountability piece is in place in ways that it hasn't been before. The step is, how do you get beyond that accountability to actually having these larger corporations that sustain these artists also be accountable also? I mean, that's where it's kind of interesting, right? In some ways, Rick Ross is low-hanging fruit. He's not all that important to folks, right? When you think about artists who are much more powerful and much more visible and are holding up many more of the bottom lines of so many other corporate interests, you know, that's where it becomes a challenge, right? You know, it's the difference between if we were going after, say, an Ezekiel Elliott in some sort of context, and if we're talking about professional sports, versus LeBron James, right? It'd be so much more difficult to hold LeBron James accountable because, you know, there's just a whole, all these other structures in which he matters in ways that Ezekiel Elliott doesn't.
We have been talking to Mark Anthony Neal, professor of African and African American Studies at Duke University, and Britt Julius, a critic and writer for numerous publications, including the Chicago Tribune, New York Times, Esquire, etc. We've been talking about separating art from the artist. Britt, Mark, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
As always, we want to hear from you. Do you think about musicians' actions when listening to their art? Are there certain musicians that you morally wrestle with? Leave a message on our hotline and tell us about it. 888-859-1800. Coming up, we review the latest from Queens of the Stone Age and The National. That's in a minute on Sound Opinions from WBEZ Chicago and PRX.